Come into the circle of love and of justice. Come into the community of compassion and of holiness and of truth. Come, and you shall know wisdom, and you shall know joy, and you shall know peace. I greet you with the words of Israel Zangwill, who 20th century British novelist and playwright. I am Reverend Fritz Hudson, minister of the Unitarian Church of Lincoln, which I think you have heard of and had contact with a lot through my predecessor and good friend Charles Stephen. I'm pleased to be here with you this morning.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Severs, and I'll be your convener today. And on behalf of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, I would like to welcome Reverend Fritz Hudson and all of our other guests with us today. Please join us after the service for coffee and conversation. And now I would ask Reverend Hudson to light our chalice as I quote, "Four wise men." There is nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy. All you need is love. All you need is love. All you need is love, love. Love is all you need. So in the spirit of Valentine's Day, let's stand up and greet our neighbors.
So Jessica thinks I can pull you back into order. I'm not sure that's true. If I wave a hymnal and encourage you to find number 299, and I'll look to see whether your hymnal is the same as mine, I'm hoping we can sing "Make Channels for the Streams of Love." Okie dokie.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was handed a couple of announcements. Andrew McKnight, who is giving the sermon next week, is having a house concert at the Tononas on Sunday night. Join us for cozy fun with friends in music, Sunday the 23rd. The potluck begins at 5 p.m. and music starts at 6. RSVP to Scott or Kathleen. And the other announcement, contact Pat Embers or Diane Barker on their workshop here at UU this coming Saturday afternoon, 1:30 to 5, on brain gym exercises, balavisics, rhythmic ball techniques, plus various sensory integration activities. Adults and children 5 and over are welcome to learn these movement techniques for stress management, good coordination, improved concentration, and just plain fun. Flyers are available from Pat or Diane today. And now it's time in our service to share our joys and concerns. Please raise your hand and wait for the microphone.
Hi, Linda Kreger. I'm happy because my oldest son, Jacob, is here visiting from Denver.
Hi, Shirley Hobrock, membership chair. We have a joy. We have another new member, Kay Garrett. Would you stand up, Kay?
Hi, Amy Fowler, and I'm supposed to let everyone know from Laura that Tori left pretty abruptly last week, and they're having a pretty hard time with it, so...
And for those joys or concerns not spoken, we hold you in our hearts. And now Michael Oldfather directs our choir in singing Alleluia for Our Time.
getting the front row, huh? Good. So we're doing this as a team this morning. Jessica is going to show the pictures, and I'm going to tell the story. But I hope you'll listen to the story's words, because I'm going to ask you some questions afterwards, okay? Not really a test, really a test of what you're thinking, but there's no wrong answer to the questions. The story is called The Memory String, and it's about Laura, whom you can see there, and about Whiskers, her cat, okay? Laura sat under a tree in their small backyard. Whiskers, her cat, lay beside her. On the porch, her dad and new stepmother, Jane, were painting the railings. Jane stopped. "Want some lemonade?" she called. Laura shook her head. While Jane was still looking in her direction, she took the memory string from the little red box on her lap. The buttons strung on the string shone in the light. Jane dipped her brush in the paint and went back to work, but Laura pulled out the string a lot in front of her stepmother. Now she told Whiskers in a loud voice so that Jane could hear, "This was my great-grandmother's memory string. Then it was my grandmother's and then my mother's, and now it is mine." "Are you sure you don't want some lemonade?" her dad called. "If you're not doing anything important, you might come and help us," Jane's voice was a little sharp this time. "I am doing something important," Laura said. And back to Whiskers, she said, "This button came off my great-grandmother's first grown-up dress." Whiskers got bored and got up to leave. Laura took a firm grab on his stomach. "Can you show us her on the stomach?" "No, I think we'll see if we can find him next time. Let's look at the next one." "Yeah, you know how you grab a cat, hold it? That's what she's doing there." Took a firm grab on Whiskers' stomach. "Yow, Whiskers," he warned. "Be quiet," Laura whispered. "You've got to stay here." Now she peered up under her bangs, and she saw her dad pouring lemonade. So that's the next one, I think. There you are. You got it. And Laura saw him touch Jane's neck. He did that a lot. Sometimes at night after Laura had gone to bed, she'd hear them whispering and laughing softly. They seemed so happy. It hurt Laura to hear them happy like that. She rubbed the buttons between her fingers and said to Whiskers, "This button came from Mom's prom dress." She glanced up at Jane again. She didn't hate Jane, not really. It's just that Jane had gone and married Dad. She had to rush now. Next question, next one. Because Dad was coming down the front steps. "This khaki one, this button," she said, "was off of Dad's uniform when he went to war. Mom cut it off of his jacket when he came home." Now Dad stood in front of her. Before he could stop her, Laura said, "And this last one fastened the neck on Mom's nightgown, the one she was wearing when she died." She held up the memory string, and the colors blurred through the blur in her eyes. Then, all of a sudden, ta-da! Whiskers leapt out of her hands, and his claws caught onto the string and broke it, and the buttons flew in all directions, falling into the grass. "Oh, no!" Laura cried. Up on the porch, Jane dropped the paintbrush and rushed down the steps. "Oh, it's okay, sweetie. We'll find them." And the three of them searched in the grass. "I found one," Dad said. "Here's another one," Jane called. And one by one, Laura put the buttons carefully back in the box. "There were 43, she said. "I'm still missing 7. So they sifted through the leaves and the dead blossoms, and they found 6 more. "Do you know which one is still missing?" Jane asked. "It's the one from Dad's uniform. It was Mom's favorite." And tears streamed down Laura's face. Jane took a step toward her. "Oh, Laura," she said. "It was what Mom would have said, what Mom would have done." But Laura whispered, Dad? They searched again after supper until the light faded. You can turn it now. When she finally went to bed, Laura just couldn't sleep. She lay listening to the crickets, but a little later she heard voices. Dad was saying, "You know, my old uniform is in a box in the attic. I can cut a button off and drop it in the grass. She'll never know." Jane said, "You can't cheat Laura like that. Those are true moments on that string. She'd rather have that button missing than have a replacement." And then she added, "It's like a mother. No substitute allowed." Jane had a choke in her voice. Laura heard it, and she got a little choked up herself. Jane said, "Let's look some more now with flashlights." So Laura went softly to the window, and she watched the white circles of the flashlights and the dark figures of Jane and Dad crawling in the grass, and then she heard Jane's excited voice. You can turn it. "I found it!" And she held up something between her finger and her thumb. "Whoopee!" Dad swung Jane around and around. "You can give it to her at breakfast." "I don't think so," Jane said. "She won't like that I found it. Let's just leave it on the porch and say it was a gift from the good fairy." So Laura got slowly back into bed, and she lay there thinking. And she heard Jane's sad voice saying, "It's like a mother, no substitute allowed." She remembered the soft look on Jane's face today when she came down from the porch and the ways that she understood about the true moments on the string. Laura had so much to think about. That's right there, stop it. That's it. She had so much to think about. What do you think she had to think about? What was Laura thinking about? Go ahead.
Thinking, "Wow, they found it. I'm so happy."
How did she feel about Jane, do you think? What was she thinking about Jane?
She was probably thinking, maybe Jane isn't so bad after all.
Maybe so. Maybe so. That's kind of what I think she was thinking. What do you think Laura should do if that's what she's thinking? Anybody else have an answer to that question? Anyone else have a thought about if that's what she's thinking, what she might do? I'm going to let someone else answer if she can or he can. Or I'm going to suggest it to you if you don't want to. No. Okay. I'm going to suggest to you that we are in a church that tries to love people even when it's hard. And that even when you have strong feelings and they're mixed, you look for the part of you that can make love. And you let that part flow out. Okay? That's all I hope you think about. Thanks for coming. Dorothy Parker was a wicked wit. In the 1920s and beyond, she made her name as a writer for Vanity Fair magazine and The New Yorker. And many of her pieces found humor in her own romantic disappointments. She, in fact, was married three times, twice to the same man. For me, her most memorable rhyme has always been this very short one. "Oh, life is a glorious cycle of song, a medley of extemporanea, and love is a thing that can never go wrong, and I am Marie of Romania." Franz Kafka, of course, was an inventive novelist. A Bohemian Jew, he lived for 41 years that spanned the turn of the 19th into the 20th century. He never married, but he is known to have had intense relationships with at least three women. Twice he was engaged for a period he lived with one of his lovers, and he once wrote, "Love has as few problems as a motor car. The only problems are the driver, the passengers, and the road." That's it. Love at its best is an adventure. At its worst, of course, it is a tragedy. What it always is moving and changing, lifting us up and dragging us down. And yet, very, very few of us would or even could separate ourselves from pursuing love's power. The only thing constant about love is its universality, and the only thing universal about love is its inconstancy. Love, the word, the idea, of course, has more than one level of meaning. And I believe that our faith affirms love in its many forms. This story, the memory string, I use this morning to try to help us at all ages to recognize that feeling love and expressing love, even within a family, often confuses us and presents us with significant challenges, indeed obstacles. Now, when it's just us adults, I'd like to explore some of the challenges that we face in trying to create the seed of a family, in trying to turn romantic love into committed love. And as scary as you folks are out there, I must introduce the scariest person in my audience, my wife, Ginny Gross, so that you will know that no matter what you're thinking of what I'm saying, I'll hear about it from her most profoundly thereafter. I will be leaving you with a question or two, and I understand it's your pattern to invite responses. I want to invite those responses, just as I invited those from the children as I close. I think we have to begin by affirming our core animal urge to couple sexually, bodily, what is often termed using the Greek word eros. We, and I mean those of us in the faith of Unitarian Universalism, affirm erotic love as the life force which ensures the continuation of the human species and which makes possible the transcendent unfolding of human culture. We affirm it as a gift of grace from which we can shape even greater beauty through our will, but at other levels then. From erotic love, we can grow the love of what we call friendship, what the Greeks called philia. This is the love that looks beyond the lovers, beyond their private pleasure and beyond their private pain. Back in the formative years of Unitarianism, two persons formed an intense literary partnership that profoundly shaped our faith, named Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller. In the 1830s and 1840s, they co-edited the magazine The Dial, which was the mouthpiece for what became known as transcendentalism. The erotic force which was kindled between these two great souls, Emerson and Fuller, is abundantly evident from their surviving correspondence. To touch the pages that hold their words can fairly burn your fingers, I'll tell you. But their attraction almost certainly never made a physical coupling. Emerson held faith in his marriage to Lydian, and Fuller was always respectful of that faith. Still, the filial marriage of their spirits is captured in their thoughts, and they have them, I think, in two very succinct kernels. Emerson wrote, "Do you love me?" really means, do you see the same truth as I do? And Emerson and Fuller wrote, two people love in one another the future good that they aid each other to unfold. And yet, as human culture has found its way out of tribalism and out from the suspicion and fear of the differences among us, time and time again, we have let our fear of love's power form barriers, form obstacles in love's path at its earliest erotic expression. In our English-speaking culture, the archetype for such obstacles and the senseless, devastating pain and waste that they can bring is, of course, Shakespeare's tragedy of Romeo and Juliet. You, of course, know that story every bit as well as do I. Romeo is of the family of Montague and Juliet of the family Capulet. In their city, Verona, these clans are entrapped in a blood feud transcending generations. And at their meeting, when they fall for each other, Juliet and Romeo know nothing of each other's family names. They're in a costume ball. So then later, when those names are learned, Romeo must moan, "Oh, my life is my foe's debt." And Juliet can only cry out, saying, "My only love sprung from my only hate. Too early seen unknown, and known now too late. Prodigious birth of love it is to me that I must love a loathed enemy." Eventually, that, of course, leads to their deaths, each by suicide. They come inevitably through a tortured progression of misunderstanding and miscommunication, which actually carries four other lives to their ends as well. They are the monumental confirmation of Romeo's words spoken under Juliet's window on the night of their meeting. "Stony limits cannot hold out what love can do that dares love attempt." You know also, I suppose, that Arthur Lorentz saw similar obstacles to love present in our time in America's urban gang culture, and as therefore he could take it into a dramatic form in the 1957 Broadway musical, West Side Story. It's Romeo and Juliet, just on the east side of New York. But I think our time and culture has seen even more painful obstacles placed in love's path. Their costs may not have been as deadly as in these classic tales, but they have been more tragic, and that because they have been so unnecessary. I hope you know the name Robert Fulghum. Any people know that name? Not as many as I might have expected. I know I am getting old in this process. Bob's 5 years older than I am, I think. He's a Unitarian minister, now in his third decade, living out what must be the fantasy of hundreds of Unitarian and Universalist ministers. It began in 1988 when one of his church newsletter columns was read by accident by a literary agent, and it began, this newsletter column, "All I really needed to know I learned in kindergarten." And the ancient agent asked him if he happened to have written anything more like that, and Bob said, "Yeah, drawers full of them all around me." Every week we wrote newsletter columns. And so the agent said, "I think there's books in these." And they have led, in fact, to 8 published books and a syndicated newsletter column that Bob has been able to put out. He hasn't preached a sermon since, I don't think. One of those books is called True Love, and it houses stories that people told or wrote Bob when he asked them, "Tell me a love story, not one that you've read or heard, one that you have lived." 3 of these stories, I think, help us better feel the cost of tragically unnecessary obstacles for love in our time. And so I'm going to read those stories and comment a bit upon them and then seek your comments yet further. Let me first tell you Percy Hilo's story. Percy wrote to Bob, "I was a high school junior in a suburb of Cleveland in 1964-65 when I met the very lovely and pleasant Brenda Andrews in an art class. We shared small talk and humor and attitudes and obvious enjoyment of each other's company. In fact, I soon was certain that I wanted her to be my girl. So the next step was to ask her out, right? Wrong. I'm Caucasian, and Brenda is Afro-American, or colored, or Negro, as we said in those days. And in the mid-60s, and in suburban America, race mixing was absolutely and positively not done. It could be harmful to one's physical, emotional, and social well-being, and sad to say, I didn't have the courage to buck my society at that time. So Brenda and I remained friends till we graduated, and then we never even saw one another again. Since then, I have thought about her often and always believed that she shared my feelings and may have felt as helpless as I about our impossible situation. I used to resent society for placing us in that position, and I wish that I could see Brenda again and complete our story by telling her how I felt. I long ago ditched those feelings. But people are constantly being and feeling trapped by various prejudices, and my story might convince some of them to follow their hearts. Now, I suspect that many of us are old enough to know the truth in Percy's story. If those younger among us feel it less surely, I can only hope that that's because more of us since have felt able to follow their hearts, as he felt he couldn't. There is, of course, no death directly traced to the obstacle that Percy and Brenda felt in their erotic possibilities, but they surely stopped their future cold. And who knows what philia went undeveloped and unlived in the wake of that inability to get even that first step down the road. So now a second story, again from True Love. The person who tells it permitted Bob only to print her initials and the location from which she wrote. So this is SGF's story of Louisville, Kentucky. And perhaps when I tell it to you, you will understand her reticence to have her name known more broadly. She writes, "My mother is 45. I am 25. She and my dad met and married and had me while they were still in college. And as far as I know, they've had a good marriage and a good life. When she was going back to her 25th high school reunion a couple of years ago, she got out her high school yearbook and all her keepsakes from those years, and she started showing them to me. And I was amazed to see how much my mom and I looked alike at the same age. We went through the whole yearbook, and when she came to one boy's picture, she began to cry. The boy's name was Benny, and she went steady with him for 3 years, she said. They were madly in love, but her parents and his parents were against the relationship because he was Jewish and her parents were Baptist. Benny and my mom wanted to run away together or elope or get married, at least go to the same college. But their parents arranged so that they would go to college on opposite sides of the country. Benny and my mom tried to keep things going, but it didn't work. My mom fell in love with my dad, and Benny went to medical school and became a flight surgeon in the Air Force. They, in fact, met again at that reunion. I don't know what happened there. My mom didn't talk about it and how she felt about seeing him, but I did find out that he wasn't married. And then about a year ago, my mom gave a dinner party, and she invited me to come and meet some old friends of hers from her high school days. And when I walked into the room, I saw one of the most attractive men I had ever seen, truly tall, dark, and handsome. He was introduced to me as Dr. Benjamin. He was my mom's Benny. And it was love at first sight for him and me. Now, to make a long story short, we had a wonderful romance. We kept it secret at first. It seemed like such a crazy thing. We even went to see a psychologist and a marriage counselor. We wanted to make sure it was really me whom he loved and not my mom. But finally, we did decide to get married. We told his parents first, and they said it was fate. When we told my mom, she cried and got hysterical, and then she laughed. I think both she and my dad are relieved at the way that things turned out. We got married 2 months ago. So far, so good. Only time will tell if we did the right thing. But that, of course, is true of any marriage. So I wonder how we feel about this obstacle to love. Overcome, we might say, in a way. We can't be too quick to judge, to be sure. SGF, as she represents herself, is surely right that only time will tell if this resolution will work out for her and for Benny and for their family and perhaps those beyond. I hope you would allow me to think that overcoming the barrier that Mother and Benny felt in their time has set their families down a path fraught with a bit of danger, perhaps unnecessary danger. To recall Romeo's words, what love can do, that dares love attempt. I hope perhaps I could be forgiven for wanting that love need not be quite so daring as these two have been. And now this final story, again from True Love, written by Katie Gerstle of Northampton, Massachusetts. After graduating from college, I went alone to South America to travel and to work. 3 months into my trip, I met and I fell in love with a Chilean named Carlos. We had a brief but exhilarating love affair. I returned then to Berkeley, ready to do the traditional thing, to find a nice Jewish boy, have a big wedding, and make my mother happy. And then I fell in love. I fell in love hard and crazily and head over heels, unable to do anything but think about how in love I was. We spent 2 glorious weeks lying in bed, talking and talking, connecting with our minds and our bodies. The only problem was that my new love was a woman. When we met, Jill had been casually dating a man and, like me, had sworn off women. My mind said, Katie, this is not a nice Jewish boy. Why make life so hard for yourself? But my heart said, Katie, you'd be an absolute fool to let this one go. Well, I listened to my heart. And thanks to my heart, 7 years later, I have never been happier. Jill is my best friend and my lover. She is my co-conspirator, my confidant, and the most unself-conscious person I know. She's taught me what it's like to grow up in working classes. I taught her how to win at Scrabble. Collectively, we have been through 8 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, deaths in the family, times of extreme bliss, and times of just trying to survive. Our relationship is ever-evolving. And in 1 month, our first child will be born. It has not always been easy. We have had the windshield of our car painted with "We kill homosexuals and we'll get you too." I had to struggle against my own homophobia. But it's a struggle that I have never regretted. In choosing Jill over waiting for that nice Jewish boy, I chose love over safety and over societal acceptance. And it's the best choice I have ever made. Now, I can imagine you saying at this point, finally, a love story with a happy ending. A story of an obstacle overcome completely and healthily. A story ending not in death, nor in wistful disappointment, nor in daunting daring, but ending sweetly in new life. Yes, of course, that can happen. Of course, it does happen. We, I think, in this faith community celebrate these triumphs every time they arise and within us and around us. And yet in the celebration, I have a wish to share. My wish is that we deny not the triumphs that are thwarted by obstacles. And I ask that we forget not the triumphs twisted by those things they have to work their way around. If we are to succeed in our quest to transform romantic attraction into committed love, especially lifelong committed love, we must face and respect the obstacles which we, in fear of our simply undeniable diversity, place in love's way. Daniel Day Williams was an American theologian of the 20th century, and he left us, I think, with good words to ponder, to keep in our minds and our hearts. And I'm going to place them before us now as I invite us to perhaps a full minute of silent reflection on love and obstacles in your own lives. I invite you to reflect on the obstacles you faced in your pursuit of love, those that you have backed away from, those that you have perhaps worked around, those that you may have overcome. And I will close our silence in thanks for our shared presence with open hearts as well as minds. And then I will invite any reflections or queries you would like to offer to us as an assembled body of faith. Let me then head us into silence with Daniel Day Williams' words. Love does not resolve every conflict. It accepts conflict as the arena in which the work of love is to be done. Love does not put everything at rest. It puts everything in motion. Thank you for your presence.
Please. Your own thoughts on love and its obstacles.
I have a sweet story that I'd like to share, and that is, my folks were married, oh my gosh, well over 50 years, and when Dad passed away, and Mom was really sad because they were best friends, and then about a year and a half ago, my mom met a sweetheart. And here she is. She's almost 89 years old, and they are very happy. And the very best thing is that all of us brothers and sisters are able to say, and mom, are able to say, you know, Dad would really be happy that you're with someone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she could have kept up a big obstacle, but she had that faith in her love with Dad that she knew it was okay to keep on loving, mm-hmm. and not just to say, okay, I have to close everything off now.
Thank you.
It's all right, Kathleen. I'm not going to involve us.
Yeah, that's right. Careful with that microphone.
She was reluctant to let loose of it. In my high school, we had to read and spend some time with a Shakespearean play each of the 4 years. And the freshman year was Julius Caesar. The sophomore year was Romeo and Juliet. I don't remember the junior year. The senior year was Hamlet. But I remember that my friends and I, ninth graders, we liked Julius Caesar. There were all sorts of nice things in it. And several of us were taking Latin for the first time and could say et tu, Brute, say it right, and other things. But Romeo and Juliet was a big problem because it just seemed so damn dumb. I mean, I shared this with lots of my other fellow males, adolescents. It just, why in the world did they take those drugs? Why did they do it? Why did their folks, why didn't they just leave? You know, it just seemed dumb to us that it wasn't overcome the obstacles. But several years later, a friend who was not a literary person said in the context of something quite different that a tragedy is a situation where everybody can see that it is going down the wrong path, and yet there is nothing that can stop it. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, that's what that was about. So I should go back and read it again, and maybe I'd like it better 60 years later.
Kathleen, behind you.
I heard this piece on the radio. It claimed that young people nowadays find having a sexual relationship, like a one-night stand or something, to be less intimate than kissing or holding hands. Now, I kind of wondered, what do you think about that? I didn't talk about this with anybody.
So you asked the minister out in front of everybody, huh? We have a 26-year-old daughter, almost 26, and these are the kind of questions I ask her. So fun to come home and talk to your dad, the minister. You know, I can't personally relate to that. You know, that just completely out of any bounds I have. But I think the human, both culture and person, is pretty malleable, and I think that's a possibility. What's striking to me is, I some of the rest of you probably grew up in the sexual exploration time. Yeah, that's right. The 60s and 70s, the pill had just come, and we were goddamn going to use that thing, you know, all the ways that we could. And I know that we were not at all able to understand the extent to which we would be totally changed emotionally by taking that risk to be sexual. And I with caution say, I'm not sure they do either. That's what they say feels like, you know, like a handshake. I think there's more going on there than they're probably completely able to confront. So it's like with everything else, caution is a better idea, if at all possible. But my daughter could speak very well for herself, and she's not here, so I have to leave the great big space to say there's a lot more truth out there than I would ever have at my age and my gender. To that conversation. Thanks for asking the question. You had a good answer yourself to it?
Do you want to talk?
Sorry, okay. I have a microphone. She doesn't. That's not fair.
Sorry, I think that our culture has trivialized what it means to have a sexual liaison. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just considered just something you do after being drunk, going out drinking all night, and you want some animal comfort. Mm-hmm. And then, but then, like, walking down the street holding hands, I mean, in the broad daylight, that's something, I don't know, or kissing. I mean, kissing is incredible. To think that someone would have a sexual relationship and skip kissing. I mean, kissing is really fun, like the, you know, the all that adventure and build up, and then hoping that you'll have sex someday if you really like the person. I mean, I feel like something really sad has been lost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, well, I can relate totally to that, but then I'm that old.
Well, I work with all young people, and they just endlessly fascinate me. And a couple of the guys stay after they've already punched out the clock to talk to me, and that kind of amazes me, but they really want to know what I think or what happened to me when I was young. And I have three daughters who are all adults now. They're only just now starting to ask me how I felt when I was much younger than them and who I knew and who my boyfriends were and things like that. So I don't know. It's just so very complicated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody back here with it? Yeah. They make you run, don't they?
Yeah. Scamper.
Well, your story about Benjamin reminded me of someone I know. My age mate cousin and I have been close for many years. And as we went into seventh grade in middle school and children from several schools were now together, he met the love of his life. He was the product of a fallen away Methodist and a very liberal Catholic mother. She was the child of a Jewish couple. And I think parents didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it initially at 12 and 13. You know, this is puppy love stuff. But the relationship went on and on. And her parents became more and more concerned, sufficient so that they sent her to Israel for a while. In an effort to break up the relationship. But it didn't work. And they're still together. Mm-hmm. Almost 50 years later.
So, I'm Michaela Severs. Kind of on Sylvia's question, what that makes me think about is in Pretty Woman, she, you know, she said that what she wouldn't do was kiss on the lips. So perhaps that's along the same lines.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought that was interesting. So I do think that hand-holding is more of a relationship thing. So it depends on what, it definitely depends on, like, what concepts you have of each factor into whether you think that's a big deal or not.
Yeah, and the tough part is that you may not, each of you have the same interpretation of the meaning of what you're doing. You could be talking past one another with your hands or your lips or your genitalia.
Right.
Yeah. Other reflections? Yeah, okay.
Well, sometimes these, in, you know, even in the modern times, we still have these barriers. My cousin Sadie, when she was 12, was dating, she was white. She's in Alabama. She's dating this black kid named Quinn. And I was singing, come on without, come on within, you ain't seen nothing like the mighty Quinn. But the adults were not really for it because they said that could be dangerous and all that. Because they're worried, you know, somebody might beat up Quinn or something. But we said get with the 2000s, but they're still a little back in the past back then. But they're not so much against it as that they're worried about them being hurt.
Sure. Yeah. You know, that's the way we all are when we're not emotionally involved ourselves. We're taking, you know, discretion's a better part of valor. Just, you know, control yourself here and play it safe. That's not what love's about, you know.
I brought the one who was...
Is that you or
I
me?
I guess I got my ears on here. I brought Bent down to meet my folks, and we had planned the wedding and everything. and my folks were not too happy. So even as walking down the aisle, they were still trying to talk me out of it. But after 60 wonderful years, I'm glad I didn't pay any attention to them and followed my heart.
Mm-hmm. You have to wonder if there isn't a certain amount of value in resistance for love. In other words, it's kind of like, who was it, Stravinsky says, if you don't give me a structure, I can't play beautiful music. It's kind of like if you're not fighting a little bit against, you know, caution or societal norms, it may not be near as much fun. Other thoughts or reflections? I can easily pull this to a close and say thank you for having me as your guest again. And I'm sure that some of you would like me to say good words to Charles and Pat, since they've been here most recently, I think, and probably we'll see them again at some time in the future. We have a closing hymn, which I think is 95. Is that right? 95.